Welcome to Vape Village, the podcast for the Victorian Association for the Teaching of English. My name's Ernest Price and I'm the Education Officer at Vape. I'm recording today on the land of the Boomerang and Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to any First Nations people who are listening today. This episode of the podcast features excerpts from the Sunday of our recent state conference. The conference theme was drawn from the work of Emily St. John Mandel. Across the entire program, speakers addressed the quote from Station 11, "Because survival is insufficient," looking at the many ways that educators are challenged to continue to develop our practice. One of the unexpected upsides of 2020 is of course that we were able to have speakers from across the globe. We began the day with a keynote from Ernest Morell, the Coyle Professor in Literacy Education and Director of the Centre for Literacy Education at the University of Notre Dame. His keynote addressed the notion of culturally responsive pedagogy.
Some of the principles that emerge from this research base, all students possess languages and literacies and stories that matter to them. And all students come to us as experts in the cultures which they have been raised. All students can become more engaged through culturally responsive instruction. There is no centering that has to happen. This is a large tent that we can create where students feel voice and have that voice. Representation matters. You know, and silences speak volumes. Our curricula and our classroom and school libraries have a deal to say about whose stories we value, you know, and so I think that's important too. Voice is important, and I'm going to highlight that, but so is representation. I'm not going to be able to talk about all of these practices, but I thought I'd have this slide, and as I said, Emily, I'm happy to share these with you and with all of your colleagues in VATE. Students getting to choose what they read is important. Reading to students and having interactive discussions, even our secondary students, even those that are approaching adulthood, can benefit from interactive teacher-led discussions and read alouds, multicultural literature, multicultural readings of literature, student voice, which I'll talk a lot more about. Incorporating youth popular culture wherever we can, in the curriculum, even when we're teaching canonical works from centuries past, we can make connections to contemporary youth popular culture, writing genres, the media literacies, and youth participatory action research I'll talk much more about. And having students write for authentic audiences and multiple voices, if not now, what would be a better time to hear from young people, right, to help teach us all? And I think that it's a win-win when we open up our beings to the voices and the wisdom of young people. Certainly, they need the wisdom of teachers and elders, but that dialogue is mutually intuitive. We all become better when we are engaged in that dialogue and when young people are invited into it.
Next up, we have an excerpt from one of our guest speakers, Kath Moore. Kath is an award-winning screenwriter, teacher, and filmmaker. Her work, Metal Fish, Falling Snow, her first novel for young adults, was released this year. In this excerpt, she talks about the way that reading can be an act of creating a safe space for young people.
But every Saturday, we would go to the Kingston Library, a 70s brown brick building, my memory still assures me. A library card that was made from cardboard and books that were still date stamped. The book racks that you could spin round and round. Life in all its enormity, sectioned neatly into rows and alphabeticized. The wondrous maze of wandering down aisles, steeped in that silent reverence for the written word. The corduroy beanbags in the kids' corner where you sank down as deep as you could, firmly anchoring yourself before launching off into your chosen book. Reading provided an escape route, literally shielding me from other people's gaze, but also allowing me to find comfort in the shape and structure of story. that a story has the beginning, middle, and end is really rewarding for a child who lacks that kind of definition and permanence. For most of my childhood, I held my breath. I didn't realize how often I did this until I was much older, but it was one of my coping mechanisms. When I read, I forgot to hold my breath. The process of reading kept me safe.
Our first panel for the day addressed the right to write creative writing in senior English. The panel featured a host of curriculum leaders and writers talking about the role that this kind of writing has in our classrooms.
One of the reasons creative writing died in Victoria was that it was said to be too subjective, that you couldn't mark it accurately. I don't know why this is not a problem for art subjects and why it has to be a problem for English. And I think it'd be great to tell the Booker Prize judges that you can't judge what's a good novel or not. Anyway, what are your thoughts on what makes for quality writing and how we should judge it? Richard, can I ask you first?
I'm bouncing off what Annalise said before, but I think, you know, there is something about writing as a place to establish responsibility, a place to be intellectually involved, a place to have a kind of sense of community that is really, really important. And there's something kind of in writing where you as a creative writer, and this is kind of slightly limiting to narrative here, but you've got this responsibility for world building, you've got this responsibility for your care of characters, and that's something that you carry out into the real world as well. And it's kind of funny when you're talking about the judging and that type of stuff, because I'm in the middle of judging the poetry for the Premier Awards at the moment, and I've been thinking about how oddly similar that was to some of my high school marking experiences. I'm just like, wow, it's really, I feel very much that I'm kind of looking for certain aspects in this writing, looking for ways that this writing connects to the world and expresses the world and says something in a way that is original and unusual and genuine. And that was what I was looking for in high school writing as well. And I'm still looking for it now when I'm looking at these published books of poetry. It is connection to the world. It is being intellectually expansive and engaged with the world, which I think is really important.
Yeah, I can see Suzanne nodding furiously there. So Suzanne, let's cut to you.
Okay, I just was thinking about, I mean, if we want to avoid subjectivity in assessment, then we get to the point where it makes more sense to use a robot, you know, an algorithm to mark the NAPLAN test than a human being. You know, that's the end point of all you can do is count clauses, really. So I don't buy that for the reasons. The rubricization, I don't know if that is a word, but, you know, rubrics didn't always exist either. In English teaching, if you taught back as far as I did, we still managed to assess before we'd invented rubrics. And my first job outside the classroom was as a curriculum advisor for English, helping people learn how to write rubrics, which I have always known is a much more complex art than we usually recognise. So, yeah, we don't... I think it's completely possible to mark all sorts of work, like in visual arts, as the example that you used. In the English Extension 2 in New South Wales, it's interesting because the students develop a major piece, a short story, a suite of poems, a film in Year 12, and they sort of have a process piece that goes with it that talks about their intention and their influences and the extent to that what shaped their creative practice. I think that's very common in the visual arts world as well, that you keep the process journal. That's one way of, does the piece achieve, to what extent does the piece achieve its intention, which is how, and is able to articulate that. That's how I mark a lot of things at university, like PhDs even. Mm.
And the process journal can be important too in terms of authentication, because that was one of our other issues with creative writing, that if as with real writing, you give students time to do their writing outside school and think about it and not do it in exam conditions, then they get their tutors to help them if they're rich kids. And
the middle of the day featured a forum about the role of the humanities in our democracy. As the arts come under increasing attack from our federal government, the speakers on this forum considered what this may mean for our society.
Or to what extent what's happening at the moment with the humanities is the result of the deterioration of public language and public debate, and if people have something to say about that and how, not just how bad it is, but what we can do about it. And we've been saying in the chat that this is with the US presidential debate fresh in our minds.
Yes, what a debacle that was. I had the good fortune to be in a meeting for the entirety of it, but I still couldn't avoid it completely. I mean, I think we've been talking about the declining capacity in public debate for a couple of decades at least now, but I'm sure that goes much further back. I mean, I come to forums like this. I do quite a lot of public speaking, a lot of engaging, and I think, well, no, we have this. We have a fabulous public debate actually, in smaller, discrete, but porous environments like this one. I think the media, the quality of debate in media, and the narrowing of media ownership. To look at structures. The amount of media that in Australia that is now controlled by the Murdoch Empire, you know, is directly responsible for the narrowing of perspectives that we have on offer. So I think it has weirdly been one of the benefits of the pandemic. Like Wesley, I'm looking for those silver linings where we can find them. People are availing themselves of this kind of online forum, these online debates in a whole range of spaces. I notice there's 125 people online here. I don't know how many you would get in a face-to-face conference, but you know, for in the Indigenous Settler Relations Collaboration, we moved our seminar series, which would get around 30 people online, and we're now getting over 200 every time. It went up over 300 during the last conversation, including people from Japan and Canada choosing to log on. So I think that, you know, we've talked for many years now about the promise of technology in terms of public debate and haven't seen a lot of evidence of it. We've seen, you know, click for clickbait and you know, the internet become that kind of space. But actually, these kind of forums using technology to connect people into public debate in a different way is possibly a silver lining of what's been a fairly atrocious period.
Our guest speaker in the afternoon was Suzanne Chu. Suzanne is the Associate Professor in the English Language and Literature Academic Group at the National Institute of Education, Nanyang Technological University in Singapore. In looking at issues of cosmopolitanism in literature, she explored the way that we can apply an ethical lens to our text study.
Now I want to move on to some practical examples of how we can enact cosmopolitan literacy in our curriculum. So I'm going to offer four key strategies. The first is analyzing text through an ethical lens. So just earlier we saw that, you know, a lot of people think that and continue to think, even in Singapore, that the ultimate aim of literature education is critical appreciation, right? In Singapore, we have a national syllabus, and in the previous syllabus, When you look at the first paragraph, it says literature is centered on the critical appreciation of language. And we have this thing called the five areas of study, which may be familiar with to you. So, you know, plot, character, setting and atmosphere, style and theme, right? What happens is with this new criticism approach is that students really are immersed in the aesthetics of the text, and they don't see the connection with the world, with their world. So what I'm proposing is that we can also add an ethical layer. It is not about dismantling aesthetic appreciation. It's not about doing away with new criticism. It is about adding to it, adding an ethical layer to looking at text. So for example, plot. Instead of just looking at plot devices, plot development, we can also look at plot in terms of the ethical dilemmas and the underlying ethical values informing plot. Okay, setting. Instead of looking at setting in terms of time and place and mood and the physical details of setting, we can look at how physical symbolic borders are established in particular settings in text and how this connects to power, injustice, and other ethical questions. Character. Instead of looking at, one of the most common questions in literature is like, what is your impression of this character? You know, what are the character traits? But instead of that, we can also evaluate this idea of virtue, which I'll come to later, and the values underlying this.
Our afternoon panel considered the question of what is taboo in the English classroom. The panel featured educators as well as a student perspective, looking at the cultural and social norms that inform what we read in the classroom.
All right, I want to talk about two possible ways, I guess, that sometimes people would justify why it might be beneficial or important, or however we want to frame it, to be engaging with ideas like this. And I can see that they're actually ideas that people have been bringing up in various forms in the chat already. So just a reminder, keep those ideas coming. It's great to see everyone's contributions. So one of the ideas that I think we've already touched on a little bit is to do with authentic learning. This idea that these are things that already exist in the real world. They're already things that in a lot of cases students are already familiar with or might have already experienced or know people who have experienced taboo topics like this. So there's some research here a couple of years back from Hess talking about how we tackle controversy in the classroom, and this idea that, yeah, that maybe there is actually, rather than giving ourselves permission to engage with ideas like this, that it's perhaps even an obligation, as in our role as teachers, that we should be having conversations like this that are already or will at some point be part of students' lived experiences. So that's leading in really to what is our role as teachers? And one of the points that's made here by Taylor is that our role as teachers is arguably either ill-defined or at the very least we could say open to a variety of interpretations. Our role as teachers in the broad sense, but specifically our role as English teachers as well, when English itself doesn't have one agreed definition of what our purpose is, what we should be doing in the English classroom. Obviously our identity as teachers is also open to interpretation as well. And I think I wouldn't be alone here in saying that that can come with some conflict at times between various ideas I might have about what it is important for students to be talking about and engaging with.
The last session of the day was our second keynote speech from Parsi Salberg. Parsi is Professor of Education Policy and Research Director at the Gonski Institute for Education of the University of New South Wales. He spoke to us about the burning issues of equity in education.
What are those things that influence student test scores in general? And I hate to use this test score thing here, but you know, this is the only narrative that we can have, because if we move beyond the OECD PISA or NAPLAN or those things, then we are in a very shaky grounds, because we cannot really say anything about anything. But you know, the those factors that influence in student test scores can be divided into different types of groups. And now you see these different colors here. And I can give you some examples. Okay, one of the influences is the teacher. Okay, the other influence is you know, rest of the school, leadership, curriculum, technology, facilities, and you know, other things. Then another factor may be something that we are not sure what it is, kind of uncertain factors. And then there can be one group of factors that is all the out of all the factors that are outside of the school gate. And you know, if we were in the same room now in this conference, I would ask you to sit down with your colleagues and try to have a conversation and try to identify how strong these different factors are when it comes to students' learning or achievement in the school. And this is what most people don't get right, is that the teacher influence is according to the studies that we have had, and including the OECD data, but kind of a serious research during the last 50 years really indicates that the teacher influence is about 10%. And another 10% or so is the other in-school factors that I mentioned earlier. So the school itself is having an influence about 20 to 30% of these, the variation in students' test scores in NAPLAN or PISA, whatever, if you use any other standardized assessment. Then we have this 20 to 25% unexplained variation that we don't know. It may be the teacher or school or curriculum, something like this, but it's not certain. But this blue one, that is about 60% of what influences student learning is something that the teachers and schools and principals have no control over. This is something that is outside of the school gate. Primarily, these things are within the family. It's a parent's education and wealth and the situation where they are, the community, the student's peer group, and many other things. And many people find this kind of hard to believe. And some people ask that, is 10% of teacher variation, is it big or small? Well, it's a big variation if we look at the in-school barriers. It's about half of the whole in-school factor that explains the invariances in students' learning outcomes. But of course it's a small, if we take the whole, the whole thing, it's about 1/10 of the whole variation. Can be a little bit bigger if we take the unexplained variation over there. So that's why, and this is the most important thing here, is that because the teachers account only for about 10 to 15% of the variability in students learning, then the best opportunities to improve quality of education are those that are the kind of a system level thing, and often things outside of the education system. And this is very important for people to keep in mind, because we cannot influence the things that are beyond our control, that are often the things that go beyond the school gate. There are some things that we can do, and this is the area where we can probably work a little bit harder to try to think, what we can do as teachers or schools to do that.
Our thanks once again to all of the incredible speakers from across our state conference. If you weren't able to attend the conference, you can still purchase the Sunday package online. This features all of the sessions you've heard in this podcast, as well as 66 pre-recorded presentations from educators around the state and indeed around the nation. It's great value professional learning, and we even have options for you to purchase it as a faculty. We hope that you are all staying safe and well out there. We know that this year has been incredibly trying, but we also know that you've been doing incredible work. We look forward to seeing you and talking with you soon.